From beanies to carry bags and from shoes to caps, browse our shop now at tntradio.live. Fighting tyranny and government overreach. This is the Mark Morano Show on TNT Radio.
Welcome to the Mark Morano Show, coming at you live on TNT Radio, originally broadcast, broadcast today, April 15th, 2023. We have a packed show for you today. We're going to be joined by former Reuters science reporter Neil Winton, 32-year Reuters veteran reporter, who has some interesting things to say about climate change. He actually came out with his view. He said, "I had no reason to think climate change wasn't established fact as a reporter." And now he says, quote, "I was wrong." And this is really refreshing to hear, someone who actually was in the trenches covering it for a mainstream media outlet for years, and talks about his evolution and how the media has changed with their coverage of climate change. You won't want to miss that. He'll be coming up in our second and third segment. But first, the whole world, well, I shouldn't say the whole world, but at least the United States is following the trend of the whole world. This week was a barn burner of a week in news because of what the Biden administration did with vehicles. You will go nowhere and be happy. That is the new motto of the great car reset. And this is a situation where we now have the Biden administration on record within 9 years is going to get new car ownership and sales from 4 to 6% of EVs currently in America to up to 67% in 9 years. It's just going to happen. You know how it's going to happen? Not with democracy, not with consumer interest, not with market forces, but because Biden's EPA is issuing executive decrees where they're just going to make it happen and they're going to force this on the rest of us. And as I said in multiple media interviews throughout the week and in my writings, this is very simply intentionally creating car shortages to force more people into mass transit, less people out of cars, pricing cars out of the price range for the average person, and creating these car shortages because there's no way you're going to have the rare earth mining, all of the materials you're going to need in order to make that kind of a transition. And the fact is, no one even wants this transition. This is, and actually, there's a great quote from a Democratic website, a man who literally is put the nail on the head, all the suffering and sacrifice. This was by the liberal patriot who wrote this. Quote, "I just don't see how we can get the working class to support a clean energy transition unless it becomes more of a crusade for abundant, cheap, reliable energy and less about the cultural commitment of college-educated Democrats." Bingo! That's exactly what this is. It's the ruling class elite saying we need to save the planet, and therefore, this is the reason we need to have these mandates and get rid of the gas-powered car. And all it's going to do is raise prices, increase scarcity. And it's exactly right. They're not selling solar, wind, EVs. They're not selling it. It'll be cheaper, easier. I mean, you hear that occasionally. But the gist of this is we have to sacrifice. And to make that point, and I'll go much more in depth on this, this is EPA Administrator Michael Regan on why Biden's EPA Administrator, Environment Protection Agency, why we need to basically ban gas-powered cars and force people into EVs. This is a situation where they actually think they can change the weather, the climate, all because they were taught this in school. They believe it. I love that. College-educated Democrats. And here's the exact quote. So anyway, Biden administration, by doing this rule in 2023 and making this allegedly happen by 2032, is going to create a situation which we've seen in Cuba, where you have a disproportionate used car market. Everyone in Cuba's case is driving around 1950s Cadillacs. And this is where they're going to literally, this is a dystopian view. And then at the same time, you can add this to what they've done in East Germany. In East Germany, the government literally has said, well, did say, collapsed in 1989 on live TV, but the government actually said we're only going to allow one car that's a government approved that you can buy. And the people were like, well, that's all we can get. So we'll get on a waiting list. Because, of course, there were shortages when government gets involved and has a monopoly and says you can only have one car. In the case of East Germany, it was the crappy East German Trabant. And this car was was literally laughed at around the world. But these people, this is all they could get. So now in the United States and in Western Europe and other Western nations, you have government saying you can only get one car. And it's going to be not necessarily a crappy car, but an impractical car and a very expensive car. And that's the EV. So this is where we are. And it literally heads to it. So I think the clip is ready. This is Michael Regan, EPA, of why we need to ban gas-powered cars and push EVs.
Let's give it up for Liz and Lena. Folks can feel the weight and the urgency the climate crisis demands. And at EPA, we have the responsibility to meet that urgency with action. That's why today I'm pleased to announce that EPA is proposing the strongest ever federal pollution technology standards for both cars and trucks. Open it up to press and take a few questions.
All right, folks, I have the mic back here in the press area. So any reporters with questions?
Together, today's actions will accelerate our ongoing transition to a clean vehicle's future, tackle the climate crisis head on, and improve air quality for communities all across the country. As a father of a 9-year-old, I can assure you that there's no greater priority for me than protecting the health and well-being of our children, ensuring that they have a safe, healthy, and reliable future.
There you go. It's about the children. That was EPA Administrator Michael Regan literally saying it's about the children. So the automobile has been around since the 19th century. And now all of a sudden we have to do this to save kids. Keep in mind that since 1970s, automobiles have radically improved their air quality, their production, their efficiency, gas mileage. And it's literally now about the children, but you heard the real reason. It's about confronting the climate crisis. This is what motivates them. This is what excites them. Remember, Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg had said, every transportation decision is now a climate decision. It's that simple. We are being hijacked. Our democracy is being hijacked. These are ideologues. I want to read this. This is what, again, from the Liberal Patriot website. I don't see how you can get the working class to support clean energy transition. This means EVs and everything, unless it becomes more of a crusade for abundant, cheap, reliable energy and less about the cultural commitment of college-educated Democrats. That bingo, bingo, bingo. And they're trying to force this on. This is the reason Donald Trump won this working class, the blue collar votes and the Rust Belt throughout America, because the Democratic Party has turned their back on him. This has become all ideology. All ideology. This is bonkers to believe that this is going to stop a climate crisis that allegedly is happening because we're going to be going to EVs. If you for a moment think that an EV is more earth friendly and climate friendly, and I'm going to go green and I drive a Tesla. £500,000, 500,000 pounds of mining material go to make one battery. It's reliance on China, where they do the rare earth mining. And by the way, Biden administration stopping rare earth mining in Minnesota, South Dakota, I believe Nevada. You can't mine for this kind of material on any substantive level in the United States. We have to farm it all out. And chiefly China, which has a monopoly on most of this in Africa, underage kids, human rights, low environmental standards. So that's point one. I like to say renewables dig the earth, not in a Brady Bunch 1970s way, but in a literal deep earth way of penetrating the earth. Then you get these cars and they get to come over here and they end up have to be literally recharged on a fossil fuel grid. The batteries have recycling issues. When the batteries go, it can cost as much or $25,000 plus on up for a new battery. And this is just like high-end consumer electronics. They will go. It's not like an engine you can keep going forever. Batteries, even if it's still functioning, doesn't mean it's functioning at peak performance. It will be dying slowly over the years as you own it. And This is the issue. This they actually think so. So by doing this, you're going to be forcing the electric car on people, and people are then not going to be able to afford a regular car. I was at a Chrysler Stellantis dealership. All they have in the showroom, all the specials are all on EVs. Now, why is that? Well, the consumer demand. But no, it's called government mandates, government subsidies, automakers, corporate government collusion, trying to push EVs on it. Now, here's the interesting thing. In the case of Chrysler, their muscle cars were all on the display. A couple of those were on the display. And guess what? They were $10,000 to $15,000 over the sticker price for a good old-fashioned V8 American car, which tells you, gee, they can ask $10,000 to $15,000. They must be expecting to get well over the sticker price for that. That tells you where the demand is. These are college-educated Democrats indoctrinated in a global warming ideology trying to force this ideology onto us in the form of electric cars. And that's what's happening ultimately. So they're intentionally creating car shortages. They're bypassing democracies. It's a gas-powered car ban. Governor Gavin Newsom did the car ban in California. 20-some states had to do trigger laws. And I'm in the state of Virginia. We have a Republican governor. He's powerless at the moment because we have a Democrat legislator. And we can't stop the gas-powered car ban because our previous governor had said, we're going to follow what California does. They're so enlightened when it comes to energy. So now you have the World Bank. At a World Bank meeting, the former head of it, Nicholas Stern, the chief economist, said we're not going to finance the creation of gas-powered cars. And he wanted to have a timetable for the elimination at the automaker level. You have corporate banks led by one in Australia say they're not going to give out car loans for gas-powered cars. If you're lucky enough to still have an old used gas-powered car, we're talking a decade or two in the future, then you're thinking, oh, well, I got my car. Well, guess what? Now you have cities in Colorado, California, literally banning the creation of new gas stations to do what? So those with gas-powered cars are going to be having car shortages, gas shortages. That's their goal. So even if you have the gas-powered car, you're not going to be able to have it. And also the other angle here is the Biden administration is pushing for a national power grid for these electric cars. And that, think of the next lockdown, like, oh, stay-at-home orders, you're good. No, you don't need to ban on interstate travel, as many Biden advisors wanted to do during COVID. You won't need that. They can just shut off the national power electric grid, having banned new gas-powered cars. You're forced into your EV. And guess what? There you go. Or you'll be forced onto public transit. And if you are, make sure you're masked up and vaxxed up, because that's how they're going to get you. You know, you won't be able to ride the bus or the train or the plane unless you literally are following every government dictate. And if you're not, hey, we have central bank digital currency coming down the road, and we can cut off the ability to spend your own frickin' money. And that is a big, big part of this as well, is the idea that they're going to prevent you from spending your own money. In fact, I believe I have this right. Clip number two. This is a leader at the World Economic Forum from the last meeting talking about how they're going to monitor your carbon footprint.
Traveling. How are they traveling? What are they eating? What are they consuming on the platform? So, individual carbon footprint tracker. Stay tuned. We don't have it operational yet, but this is something that we're working on.
The World Economic Forum is working on it. Now, with this tracker, in my book, and Great Reset, Global Elites in the Permanent Lockdown, and on my website, Climate Depot, I actually go back. The other interesting development here is these MasterCard has joined up with the United Nations to form a carbon footprint tracker card called the Dichotomy card. And this is what they're all excited about, because this card, according to the World Economic Forum, will cut off your spending the moment you hit your carbon footprint max. That's the other form of control. And just to give you an idea of how current this is in the news, this past week, David Malpass, Trump's appointee to the World Bank, and by the way, the World Bank is instrumental in preventing development in Africa, fossil fuel development, stopping coal plants, stopping gas projects because of the climate emergency. So they're helping lock Africans, stopping Africans from getting national sovereignty, because the World Bank would be a better route for them to develop than allowing China to come in and form a new form of colonialism, put them in debt. Africans owe it. China will build some infrastructure, but you know, essentially they will be economic and in some cases literal underage slaves to China as they're working all this mining. But the World Bank, David Malpass, Trump's appointee, questioned climate change last fall, in fall of 2023. And what happened was, he was condemned by John Kerry. He was condemned by Al Gore. He didn't say anything skeptical necessarily, but he sort of denied there was a climate emergency. He's out. He's gone. So who did Joe Biden replace the World Bank appointee with? Are you ready for this? Former MasterCard CEO, AJ Benga. Now, who's AJ Benga? What does this have to do with central bank digital currency and the carbon footprint tracker? Well, he was the CEO of MasterCard when MasterCard partnered with the United Nations in 2021 to produce the MasterCard Carbon Footprint Monitoring Card. It will enable tracking of your carbon footprint on every purchase, monitor and cut off spending when you hit your max. And this is the man now in charge of the World Bank. So you have... I'm sorry, the United States representative to the World Bank. So you see how this works? Corporate government collusion. You promote a credit card that works with the United Nations to cut off your spending, monitor your carbon footprint, and then you leave MasterCard, and then the Biden administration appoints you to the World Bank, where you can essentially make this happen on an international level and not just one stinking company partnering with the United Nations. This is what we are up against. This is what we are fighting, because this is a brave new world upon which we are entering, both in energy, food, transportation, free speech, and finances. And that's a big one, is finances. And in fact, there was one other thing, and then we'll go to break and we'll bring on our guest, Neil Whitten. But Michael Schellenberger has been on this now free speech beat. This is the former progressive, but he has some incredible, he's been going through talking about the creeping totalitarianism and how every Western country in the world is being essentially working with these government funded that look like private groups that are suppressing our free speech. And they're basically gaslighting and saying that the people who are being suppressed are the ones promoting extremism, when it's actually the leaders themselves. Here's a quote from Michael Schellenberger. Those urging censorship of misinformation are spreading it. Those who condemn extremism demand extreme policies. And all those who denounce hate are filled with loathing for their political enemies. He's particularly talking about former New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern. She imposed the most extreme, unpopular policies in the world, zero COVID, outdoor masking, vaccine politics. She's now going to demand censorship for her political enemies online. And he goes through it as a whole thing about these new sort of front groups that they've set up to literally put government control of free speech on the internet. But they're doing it through the private sector, and it's also being done through our intelligence, deep state intelligence departments. Anyway, this has been the Mark Morano Show, and we will be right back, because we have 32-year Reuters veteran reporter Neil Whitten joining us to talk climate change, EVs, and his view of today's modern media. We'll be right back after these messages.
You should hear what Charlie Robinson is talking about.
What do you make of this insanity with Trump? This feels really weird to me. The whole thing, after all is said and done, does he come out of this looking like a martyr?
I think so. I mean, the worst part for them, whoever them are, is not only is this case ridiculous, but on top of that, don't forget, it's the Southern District in New York that's sitting on all the Epstein stuff. They haven't indicted anyone. They haven't even questioned Bill Clinton. We're at a place where it is just persecution, political persecution, and it looks bad to the rest of the world as much as it does us, while our military-industrial complex and the Uniparty continue to instigate, I believe, wars all over the world. And to me, it's a bigger picture, which is, you know, Donald Trump right now, not only are they making him look better, but there are millions and millions of people who have been wronged by our justice system. People put in jail for white collar crimes or small crimes. People, especially in family court all over, that are right now maybe never even liked Trump, never voted for him, never voted at all, but are going to vote against the justice system and the corruption. So, I mean, they're really backfiring here.
Charlie Robinson on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
You're invited to join the pilgrimage to Bath, United Kingdom this June, where we will unveil a better way for health, freedom, and sovereignty. The Better Way Conference is a three-day solutions-based conference with more than 50 expert speakers from around the world. Our Master of Ceremonies, Neil Oliver, will take us on a journey through eight inspiring conversations addressing the issues that matter most to individuals and families around the world right now. Panel hosts include James Corbett of The Corbett Report, Richard Vobes, The Bald Explorer, and the New Americans, Veronica Karolinko, and many more. Wherever you are in the world, you can join us in person or online for less than £40 or $50 for the full program. Get your full conference, single day, or virtual passes now at betterwayconference.org. Please join, share, and collaborate with us as we create a better way for a better world.
If you're talking about it,
the United States of America should never, ever default on its debt.
We're talking about it. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Mark Morano Show on TNT Radio. We are joined now by Neil Whitten, 32-year Reuters veteran reporter, is a science reporter, science and technology correspondent. He currently writes at the blog Whitten's World or Whittensworld.com. That's WINTON.com. And Neil, welcome to the program.
Mark, hi, how are you today?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much for coming on. I don't know if you got to hear any of the opening. I'm sure you've seen the news this week, all about the global effort, and particularly this week, the U.S. effort to ban EVs, all based on the climate crisis. I played EPA Administrator Michael Regan's quote saying, we have to do this essentially for our children and because the climate crisis demands we essentially ban, they're trying to ban gas-powered cars. That's where we're headed. Gavin Newsom has talked about that. The EU has been trying to ban it. The Biden administration's intrigued with it. They don't want to call it a ban. They're trying to call them EV, you know, mandates. But essentially, you worked at Reuters for 32 years. And you said something shocking. You said, I had no reason to think climate change wasn't established fact. I was wrong, unquote. Can you tell us your history and your views on climate and how they evolved? And we'll get to electric cars after that.
Yeah, right. Well, I got the job as a science and technology correspondent in the mid-90s. And when I first thing I wanted to do was the global warming, as it was then called, a crisis was yes. A big story, and I listened to the mainstream media, mainly the BBC, talking about how everyone knew what was wrong and how we'd all die unless we changed our lifestyles. But as soon as I got the job and I started phoning around to the world's top climate scientists, I found a totally different story. I found a lot of people who weren't quite sure why, how they could justify or explain global warming. They were not, as a group, didn't seem very sure of why it was happening. Even though the mainstream media made it sound as though everyone knew quite what it was, and so we'd all have to make great sacrifices to try and curb it. But the idea that CO2 was the key to the way the climate was changing, it wasn't a proven fact, and I was left with the impression that the debate was still open, and that the answer to what was going on was it could have been a lot of it could have been down entirely to man's actions, a little bit or none at all. So the whole thing was up in the air. But even then, since then, I think we've gone along to the point where the media again assumes that it's all down to CO2, and we have to, as you were talking earlier about some of the reasons and some of the policies governments are making to try and cut it back to our use is zero.
Yeah. So when you were, now let's go back to the 90s. They actually allowed more climate dissent, obviously, than anything we see today. Today, you know, we have people like CBS News anchor, former anchor Scott Pelley, publicly announced that he won't interview a climate skeptic for CBS News any more than he would interview a Holocaust denier if he were doing a story on the Holocaust. I would say it really changed, you know, in the last decade. It got to the point where they almost don't even think of a climate skeptic as an actual human being. They're just a conspiracy nut. Did you see that kind of mentality among your colleagues in the media back in the 80s, 90s, or early 00s? I mean, was there this kind of like, we can't allow dissent to be reported?
No, not at all. I've looked back at some of my writing from the 90s, and it's all the traditional way of Reuters reporting these things. Right. It's always, on the one hand, this, and the other person says something else. It's all scrupulously balanced. And of course, that is doesn't exist at all today. And the idea that a lot of the mainstream media does, I know old colleagues from Reuters who actually said something like, I would never give airtime to someone who was a climate change denier. But the whole idea of climate change denial is an absolute nonsense, it seems to me, because everybody that knows anything at all about the science of climate change knows that the climate has been changing very slowly for maybe 10,000 years. It's been gradually warming. It's been going up. It's been going down. But the overall trend is slightly warmer. And so to call someone a climate change denier doesn't make any sense anyway, because everyone knows that isn't the case.
Yeah. Now, when you look back, what year or what era, like, what do you think was the prompt to make, let's call it, I guess, for lack of a better word, the mainstream media, everything from Reuters, BBC, the Associated Press to, you know, the three networks to, you know, the major corporate outlets. When did they decide that they had to be all in and get rid of balance? Can you pinpoint a year or a moment? Was it Al Gore's film in 2007? How did this happen? What do you think?
I don't think there's any one particular moment that triggered it. I think that it was one of these things that after a while, reporters and journalists just can't be bothered to, they constantly hear one refrain and they can't really be bothered to say it, to put a balancing item in their stories. And I think one of the interesting things that's happened recently is a book published by Ross Clark, a British journalist, called Not Zero. I was reading it, and he was wondering, why was it that now all the most media outlets seem to report the same thing about climate change? And he was saying, he pointed out to a website called Covering Climate Now. And this was supposedly dedicated to finding out the truth about the science of climate change. And a lot of media outlets have signed up to it, one of them being Reuters. And that's what picked my attention and why I wrote that story that was picked up by the Daily Skeptic. Yes. It turns out that Reuters, when it joined in 2019, the managing editor said they're proud to be linked with Covering Climate Now. This is an organization dedicated to finding out the truth, and that's all they care about. But if you actually look at their website, which now has 500 media members from across the world, led by Reuters and Bloomberg, in their advice to reporters, they say, for instance, if you're writing a story about a weather event, you know, a bit of flooding or whatever, but be sure to link it with climate change, even though there's no evidence to suggest that that's true. If any reporter bothered to Google, for instance, they could look at Stephen Koonin's book Unsettled, where he debunks this whole idea that that the climate is getting worse and worse and worse because of climate change.
Yes, he does. And he goes through, and he comes at it as a former Obama administration official, which always Indeed. Seems, yeah, the media always seems to think, you know, it's a conservative conspiracy, anyone who dissents, that the idea that carbon dioxide is causing a climate emergency. When you look at coverage today, and I think I sent you an example, like the Associated Press, Seth Borenstein, their lead climate reporter, you don't have to get into names or personal attacks, but he did a story about going gone. New study by American Meteorological Society said home runs are being juiced by global warming. And they're saying the fact that temperatures have gone up in the last few decades, you know, essentially mean that because home runs have gone up, it's due to climate change. And I sent you the analysis by the climate expert, Dr. Roger Pilkey Jr., who literally laid waste to the entire study by saying, if you look at Japanese baseball, college baseball, the minor league baseball, home runs, there's no increase in home runs. So why would global warming only affect the majors? So give me your comment on that. How does the story, and by the way, just for clarity, the Associated Press ran that story as though it were gospel. They didn't include any skeptical voices, any pushback. What is your make of that kind of a story that just came out this week?
Well, it does look, because when I first saw it, I thought it was pretty close to April the 1st, and maybe it was an April Fool's joke. But this it did seem to be stretching credulity a bit far. But maybe they think now they can say absolutely anything and not be criticized. By the way, I should have mentioned about covering climate now is that they also advise that they must never, ever interview people who are climate change deniers.
They give a reason why? Like, why can't you have, because the public can't handle it? You can't handle a dissent? Is that the idea? The public can't?
Well, yes, I think that now they all say, I think that because the science is now proven, that any dissenting voices are only standing in the way of their virtue signaling path to putting the climate right. So they think they're so sure that they're right that they're willing to do anything to silence the opposition. One of the things that I've been pointing to is, of course, you're aware of it too, the www.sepp.org, the Science and Environmental Policy Project, which I recommend to anybody because every week they regularly come up with a whole load of interesting point of view on the science of climate change, with packed with people who are really serious scientists, really with high reputations.
And that was the group founded by Dr. Fred Singer, atmospheric physics. You probably interviewed him for Reuters. He was one of the leading skeptics, especially back in the 90s.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, that's a fantastic one. Well, that whole part, let me ask you this question, even broadening beyond climate. I don't know if you heard me, but I was talking about Michael Schellenberger. He's a progressive lefty who's basically been red-pilled and now sees the world radically different from especially from a media perspective. But the gist is this. Here's my question. How can the media, with all these fact checks and the claims of misinformation, and we're not going to interview a skeptic because that's like interviewing a Holocaust denier, we're not going to interview a climate denier. How do we get to a point where even when you're talking about the Ukraine war, you're talking about just about any modern issue, if you disagree with the government position, you are by de facto a misinformation, spreading misinformation. And of course, that ties into COVID. If you said, you know, COVID was from a lab leak, if you said that masks don't work, if you said lockdowns don't work, if you said, you know, the numbers for COVID deaths are being juiced by people with COVID, that was all automatically declared misinformation. You'd be deplatformed, canceled, censored. In your view, how did the media get to the point where we would promote the Pentagon Papers from Daniel Ellsberg in the 1970s showing the lies of the Vietnam War to now circling the wagons and the media's main job, the company you used to work for, main job, sees itself as protecting government narratives from anyone who challenges them? How did this happen? And do you agree with that assessment that that has happened?
Well, I think that it's as much about laziness as it is about any conspiracy. I think that a lot of the media in the UK, the Guardian, you know, is we expect it to be pretty left of centre and into ploughing a familiar furrow. But the other media is actually even the right wing press, like maybe the Daily Telegraph, they still write about climate change, but they can't be bothered to add in the contrary opinion. I think they're probably frightened that they might be pilloried by The Guardian as a climate change denier. But I think it's more, from my perspective here, it's more of a laziness than any great conspiracy.
But their instinct seems to be young journalists in particular. The idea of fact-checking someone, again, whether you're talking about war or COVID or climate, it just seems like they take, if the government position says this, anyone who dissents is spreading lies. That seems like a, like almost like a indoctrination. I mean, do you think young journalists are being indoctrinated? I hate to use the word indoctrinated, but are they being trained like that to literally say the government is right and we have to protect the government's position? That's where, to me, at the heart of this, and that, of course, applies to climate.
Well, I think in Europe, I think it's true that this all comes from deep into the system as education. I think that our children are being educated to that there's only one point of view here, and I think most of them coming out of regular schools would say that it's a fact. We know it's happening. When you think back, for instance, when even Obama, President Obama, was talking about he was repeating the 97% of scientists agree, and when someone as important as Obama says that, that's pretty heavy stuff. That does tell a lot of people that, well, obviously there's no argument here, because someone that we respect says that 97% of the scientists agree that it's happening. So all these people are disagreeing are just time wasters, and they're going to end up stopping us saving the climate from climate from destruction.
When Obama said that, he actually said 97%, yeah, believe it's going to be catastrophic. When in reality, if you actually look, I interviewed Richard Toll, the UN lead author. He said the 97% was pulled from thin air. It's not based on any of the studies they claim. But even if you take it at face value, the questions in it are, is the Earth warming and can humans contribute to warming? Has nothing to do with whether we face a climate crisis, a climate catastrophe, whether we did justify all the laws and rules and regulations. So Obama completely, when he said that, misstated that. And I love the way people say, oh, well, according to NASA's website, all NASA does is repost that website, repost that study, a couple studies, and then a couple talking points from a webmaster at NASA. But that's how that is the bane of everything. So what happened, in my view, with the media was they got to this idea that the consensus was there and consensus is all that matters. We have a scientist named Neil deGrasse Tyson who was on, I believe he was on a British show. I can't remember the name of it, maybe Counterpoint. No. But they were talking about COVID, and all he kept saying was, you know, we have the COVID scientists, and there's a whole linkage between the COVID epidemiologists and the climate skeptics, because everything you see happened to climate skeptics over decades: deplatformed, canceled, defunded, uninvited to conferences, stripped of funding, not allowed to publish. That exact thing happened to any scientist who dissented on lockdowns, on whether lockdowns worked, on whether vaccine mandates should be instilled. And so what happened was this American scientist, Neil deGrasse Tyson, literally just kept saying, well, all I care about is the consensus. If the majority of scientists say X, then we should only listen to them. Is that how science journalism should be done? Is that how we should only look at a consensus and then forget anyone who has any opposite view? How do you respond to that when they say consensus is all that matters?
Well, I always respond by saying that that's not how science works. Science works by proof and not by vote. That's what you have to look to. And people talking about, well, everyone agrees, well, should be reminded about the likes of Galileo, who suffered rather badly from daring to question the conventional wisdom.
Well, we'll be right back after these messages with Neil Winton. We'll talk a little bit about the EVs and cars. And I know you love doing car reviews. We'll talk to you about what your views on these EV mandates are. So we'll be right back. This is the Mark Morano Show with former Reuters journalist Neil Winton. We'll be right back.
With his expert analysis and opinion,
this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
People gleeful that Budweiser and Bud Light sales are off 80% since corporate giant AB InBev decided to do a promotion with transvestite influencer Dylan Mulvaney are missing the point. Corporations no longer care about their customers. That's not their business model anymore. Their business model now is to maximize their ESG score, environmental, social, and governance. And part of ESG is DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion. And part of DEI, that would be the company's corporate equality index put out by the Human Rights Campaign, an LGBTWTF green mail operation. Corporate America couldn't care less about its customers any longer. All it cares about is keeping the professional grievance industry and its alphabet soup of idiotic hate indices appeased so that they don't end up on the wrong side of a social media hate campaign. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
Melissa from Michigan. I work an extra part-time job serving lunch at my child's school, but I still can't afford to put food on our table.
Daniel from California. Choosing whether to pay the rent or pay to fix the car to get to work doesn't leave us with much at all. Now we can't even pay for meals.
Hunger is a story we can end. End it at feedingamerica.org. Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
You're with Mark Morano on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back. This is the Mark Morano Show. We're here talking with Neil Winton, a 32-year veteran of Reuters science and technology reporting. Neil, we're talking now about the EPA in the United States. And of course, you guys and the EU, I believe, tried the gas-powered power ban. And wasn't there some pushback? Are you guys still banning gas-powered cars in Europe, or have they, well, I guess Britain's now, you're broken off from the EU, but what's happening in Britain and what's happening in the EU with gas-powered car and electric mandates? Any update for us?
Well, yes, well, we've had, there is a ban in the European Union from 2035 of internal combustion engine cars, you know, gasoline or diesel. And that was about to be signed into law by the European Parliament about 3 weeks ago. And the Germans suddenly, just before the signing, said, hang on, we don't want to do this. We want to at least allow a small role for so-called e-fuels, fuels that burn but are apparently CO2 friendly. But it's a very small niche that they've opened up. Probably will be used by Aston Martin, Porsche, and Ferrari. But it's really quite a marginal area. So in fact, they've banned internal combustion engine vehicles from 2035. Not even, I believe that the California Air Resources Board, when they came out with their ban in 2035, they at least added the allowance of plug-in hybrid vehicles, saying that people in rural areas couldn't afford electric cars and we needed some flexibility. But we don't even have that here in Europe. And the powers that be in Britain, thanks to Boris Johnson, who, as you know, is now departed, he decided that 2035 wasn't good enough, so we have to conform by 2030.
Yeah, that reminds me of the old Philip Stott, who is a UK scientist. There, he's retired now, but it was the 2000. I can't remember if it was one of those UN climate summits where Tony Blair and other European leaders were there all saying, I'm going to limit the Earth's temperature to 2 degrees and I'll do 1.5. I'll up you. I'll limit the Earth's temperature to only 1 degree. And this reminds me now what they're doing with the car bans. I'll ban cars by 24. I'll do 2035. Do we have 2020? 2030? Sold. They're literally auctioning off our future of insanity. So if they're talking, what's going on in terms of, you know, what would happen in your view? As a car enthusiast, a man who does car reviews now and loves, you know, automobiles, what would happen if they ban gas-powered cars by 2030, 2035? Is it even doable? And what would happen? Would the used car market go crazy? What would the affordability crisis be? I saw a report just this week. They're saying in Germany that half of the public won't be able to afford a car at the rate this is going because of the scarcity they're going to create with all these regulations.
Yes, I've been writing that for Forbes for some time. A lot of the European leaders of the car industry have gone along with the European Union's plans here, with one notable exception, and that's Carlos Tavares from Stellantis. He's been very bravely standing up and saying, we're getting ourselves into a terrible mix here, because as things are going, we'll get to the point where by, he didn't say 2030, but he was saying, as we try and force more and more unaffordable electric cars on the public, the regular average earner won't be able to afford a car. And he was saying, if we get to a point where only the rich are driving around in cars and the rest of us are on the bus, then there's going to be a political price to pay for that. And he's made his feelings very, very well known about that.
Oh, so in the U.S. here, like when they're talking about the banning, they're trying to, they don't use the word ban, but the effect is going to be that they're going to create a car shortage. Now, I use the analogy of East Germany, which I'm sure you're familiar with, the Trabant. The government said you can only have one car, the East German Trabant. Do you see that parallel where the EU, the United States are now telling people you can only be able to have one government-approved car, the EV? So how have we not learned from history? And then, of course, you have Cuba where they have a huge used car market. In your view, what will this do to used cars? And what will this do to the average income working collar Brit, European, and American when you put these kind of restrictions on cars? What's the goal?
Well, it's already started. It used to be that you could buy a brand new, very small car, but quite a decent car. It was a proper car anyway. It would cost about $12,000, but now that's been pushed to the point where it now costs about $16,000, and the big car companies are pulling out of that section anyway, because as the European Union regulations ratchet ever tighter, it becomes impossible to make any money out of that part of the market, and so they're gradually giving that up. Now, as you say, that is going to point people towards the second-hand market. Obviously, those prices are going to rise. But an interesting new development is companies like Toyota and some of the Stellantis companies are going into the serious refurbishment business. So maybe a car has done, 150,000 miles. It probably will be about time to return it whence it came. This refurbishment sector is now getting underway. And so they're going to be taking these old cars, putting new engines in or doing re-engineering them a bit, and then getting them back out onto the market. So there will be some place where people can buy their transport.
Wow, that would be, on the high end, I've talked to people who have like 1970s US muscle cars, and they'll pay more than $100,000 to have the car completely taken apart, every piece, air blasted, repainted, completely restored. That's obviously at a different level, but that's interesting, the idea of, because that would actually seem like a huge market in this coming political environment of all these bans. Well, let me give a broader picture. What is your view of the gas-powered car, and what's your view of EVs? Are you a big fan of EVs? Do you personally drive one? Would you want to drive one? My own view is, I love stick shift, a manual car. I drive a manual Jeep. So an EV doesn't appeal to me, at least unless they come up with a fake stick shift. I'm sure they could probably simulate one. But what is your view, so we have an idea? Are you excited about EVs? Do you think they're the future? Or do you think that gas-powered cars will always be with us, or should always be with us?
Well, I think that the gas-powered car will be eliminated if the governments have their way. But I've been driving a lot of electric cars lately. On my website, I do regular reviews, and I've got a database of about 25 reviews of all kinds of electric cars, from the Tesla Model 3 to Volvos and Renaults and Mazdas. I've got the whole load there with a lot of data about what they can really do in terms of range and in terms of the guarantee that they come. For instance, the Audi e-tron has on the tin, it says 240 miles, but if you plug it into your house, you only get 180. And this is a typical turnout when you have an electric car, that you have to be very careful about what it will actually do. But the driving of them, they drive very nicely. the performance is quite exhilarating quite often. But there's another point that no one ever seems to mention, and that is that once you point them into the fast lane, if you want to drive, you know, across Europe on a 500-mile drive, as soon as you get over 75 miles an hour, the range just drops. It can drop by maybe 30%. I drove a Polestar once that once you got in the fast lane, its range dropped by 60%. Just when you got into the normal traffic flow on Europe's fast roads.
So that's a great question. How long would it say you have the Polestar? How long does it take if you're driving and you're going fast? You had to pull over, find a recharging station. How long is it going to take to recharge it at that? Even if you have fast charging, how long are we talking?
Well, that's a very interesting question because the fast chargers are pretty thin on the ground. If you do find one, I think you can probably fill a Polestar in maybe half an hour to 45 minutes.
That's with the fast charger.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
And then, of course, a lot of them seem to be broken. A lot of them have queues and you can't get it done. I mean, it is actually a nightmare. The thing about electric cars, in my view, is they are absolutely super around town. If you want to drive in your normal daily commute to... It works very, very nicely. It then gives you the kind of range that is promised because the range probably only works to about 55 miles an hour. That's the perfect speed, I think, for an electric car to operate at. But the trouble is, if you buy one of these cars, like the Audi e-tron, you can't really take it on a long journey. So my favorite solution here is that we have a small, cheap electric car costing around $10,000 that would take two people and two children. It would have range of about 100 miles and a speed of about 65. And it would be cheap enough where it wouldn't need to have these massive subsidies that now are required to sell electric cars.
Well, do you think, yeah, I know the city of Oxford, other places are trying these 15-minute cities. The idea of an electric car, if you're only going within 15 minutes, makes sense. But the idea is long travel. They want you to stay at home. That's the idea. That we think of COVID, you think of climate. They don't want that much freedom of movement. But, well, I got to go. But thank you so much. This is Neil Winton, former Reuters journalist. He blogs at Winton's World, WINTON.com. This has been the Mark Morano Show on TNT Radio. Thank you for listening.